From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, your house just might be infested.
It has a habit of getting into people's houses at this time of year to hibernate.
The riot, not riot, in a UP prison might have been reactions to sending in armed guards when things were already settled down.
The department wanted to round up these ringleaders. Was there a way they could have done it that was less confrontational?
A little post-life humor from Stateside's live show in Traverse City.
Another favorite of our staff is, does this urn make my ash look big?
And new leadership for Detroit Focus Hope.
We're not preparing people for a job. We're preparing people for a career that they can actually feed their families.
Those stories plus White House linguistics. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Cooler weather has an invasive species trying to get into your home. And then, where were you 50 years ago when Michigan was on the brink of a nuclear disaster? We'll have those stories. But first, one of the organizations to rise out of the ashes of the 1967 uprising in Detroit was Focus Hope. It's many things to many people, but primarily it's a career training center for about 900 people each year and a distributor of food to approximately 40,000 senior citizens each month through a USDA program. This summer, Focus Hope got a new executive director. He is Jason Lee, and he joins me now. I visited your campus, sat in the class for a while, followed one of the students as she made her way into the workforce as a machinist, and visited the food distribution center on campus. So I just wanted to say, really impressive work. But first, let's talk about career training. What types of training do you offer?
Well, thank you for allowing me for being here today. I really appreciate the honor of talking about Focus Hope. As of week 8 in my new position, it has been a very exciting opportunity. So some of the work that we do, you mentioned our food program where we serve 40,000 seniors per month and provided them food. And we're not just providing a meal. We're providing actually groceries so they can actually feed their families through our supplemental food programming. In addition to the workforce development work that we're doing, which, by the way, we are in a Cisco school as well as a Microsoft school. So individuals in the community can actually become certified in these respective areas. And there's, as we all know, jobs in IT are pretty much in demand, particularly in the state of Michigan.
And you've got this long-running machinist training program,
yes,
which is, you know, in a town that makes cars, is pretty important.
Right. So one of my visions for Focus Hope is looking at the career path and the workforce, that the work that we're doing, and asking the question, how does it align with the demands of industry, and how are we preparing people for careers of the future? One of Focus Hope's training protocols, we're not preparing people for a job. We're preparing people for a career that they can actually feed their families.
We're talking about growing areas. There was a time there was talk about a nursing or healthcare program starting at Focus Hope. Did that happen?
Absolutely. We have a partnership with Oakland University School of Nursing. So there's actually a satellite location where individuals can learn about the nursing program but also become certified.
I want to talk to you just a little bit about some of the barriers to people who maybe didn't graduate high school, maybe they've been out of a job for a while. I understand a lot of the applicants, up to 50%, are turned away because they don't pass a drug test that you give. Why do you give a drug test?
Well, I think that let's talk about the education component first. So historically, Detroit school system, which many of our students are coming from, has, as we all know, has had some significant challenges.
Right. High dropout rate. The school itself is struggling and has been struggling for a long time.
Right. So the system that we have today is not providing an education at the level that we expect. Many students come to Focus Hope with a degree in hand. But after we do a testing and assessment, realize that a high school diploma, that student may be reading at a sixth grade reading level or maybe doing math at a fourth grade reading level. So as a community, as a state, we are cheating our young people who are doing the right things, going to school and getting an education, and it's not to the quality that they deserve. And I applaud the efforts to fix that and transform that. I'm a real big supporter of Alicia Merriweather in that space and as the interim superintendent of Detroit Public Schools. But we need to make a change when it comes to our education in our community. When it talks about Focus Hope, Yes, we do a drug screen on our students. We want our students to be serious about being in a training program and realizing that if you complete this program, then there's a career opportunity for you that will take you to another level.
And that first job is probably going to do a drug test anyway, so you might as well get used to the idea. Let's talk a little bit about the schooling that you were just talking about. You guys offer remedial courses. So they might come to you thinking they're going to get career training right away, but might not be ready after the testing. But they can get classes right there at Focus Hope. Adults can, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things that Focus Hope prides itself on is identifying and taking an individual who is showing initiative, saying that they want a job, saying that they want a career, and taking them where they are, either from an academic or social emotional state. So we have remedial programs. If a person's identified that reading is an issue for them, we do things as including purchase glasses for individuals. You'd be amazed how many glasses we have to purchase for an individual who, you know, may never realize that this is an issue, or hearing aids and things of that nature. We work with the partners in our in those respective areas so that those folks who are participating in our programs have the skills and resources and tools to their disposal to be successful.
What kind of success rates do students have after leaving Focus Hope?
Well, we have an advisory council for our employees, and they're clamoring for more of our students coming out. I was talking to a gentleman who owned a CNC machining shop, and he was saying that we need more students like the ones coming out of Focus Hope because they understand the language, they understand what it takes to be in that environment. And every corporation or job shop here in Michigan wants someone who has those skill sets, who wants to come to work, who's dedicated, and they can train them for the specifics around their particular industry. So there's a demand for our programs. There's demand for our students coming out of their Focus Hope.
I want to talk about the funding picture in Detroit because the foundations are kind of shifting their focus to the neighborhoods. And for longstanding entities like yours, you know, you're not the new tool in the box now. And I've seen the foundations kind of drift away because there's something else they want to do. Are you having those kinds of difficulties? Do you expect that that's going to be a problem since, you know, with everything that needs to be done in Detroit, you guys are doing okay right now?
Well, I think that's – let's talk about the neighborhood piece. So in your introduction, you mentioned our food program and our workforce development program. Something else that we have at Focus Hope is what we call our Hope Village Initiative, where we've adopted the 100 square blocks around Focus Hope and are providing resources to uplift that community. Our community, where it's geographically located, is very important. We have highway access from both the Lodge and 96. It's not far from Woodward. So as we see the expansion of the M1 rail and within our bus system and our transportation infrastructure, we're in a key community. We have a strong and active neighborhood group, as well as a police presence, which the police are working with the community to be supportive. So when we talk about community, Focus Hope is playing in that space. I think what we are looking at doing is being transformative in our work. Yes, we are a 48-year-old nonprofit that was started by a priest and a housewife. But we are still doing relevant work after our 48 years. And we talk about our founding. We were founded in 1968 after the riots or civil unrest. And many of the challenges that Detroit and the community are facing in 2016 are still relevant.
We've talked about that a lot on this program because of the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. The whole idea of making sure that we remedy some of these issues that have been around for decades and decades is a real problem. So how holistic is your – you were talking about providing glasses with your partners and hearing aids. I also understand you help them find transportation. Sometimes that's difficult in Detroit and other things to make sure that they can get to class, get the training, get the career training that they need. So what does that encompass?
Well, we're looking at a holistic model based off of our mission of providing intelligent and practical actions to counteract racism, poverty, and injustice. So the work of our food program, the work of the Workforce Development and Education Department, the work of our Hope Village Initiative, they're all intertwined in that model. You know, ideally, we would have folks from the Hope Village community participating in our workforce development programs, and we need to have more of that, admittedly, and have them engage in actually having careers. Now, the difference is we would encourage them to stay in their Hope Village, stay in the community, and be successful, generate a revenue, be able to support a family, and that's how you create community change. Our senior program is critical, 40,000 seniors. So we're distributing food to the most needy members of our community. So as we look at a holistic model, and we have some fine-tuning to do, admittedly, and we want to make sure that our work is relevant to for folks, whether we're creating jobs that are in demand, but also as the philanthropic community and the municipal governments look at systematic change for Detroit, how can Focus O be a critical player in that space?
I understand you're holding an event this weekend called Eleanor's Walk for Hope and 5K Run. Tell me about that. What is that?
So that's an exciting opportunity. So since 1975, we have had a walk for justice. And after the passing of Eleanor Josiatis, they changed the name to Eleanor's Walk for Justice. It is a couple of components. So we added a 5K component. So all of you runners out there, or we have a 5K initiative. It's going to start at 10 o'clock in the morning. Registration will be at 9 o'clock. And that's going to be an exciting and fun opportunity. We're also encouraging anybody who's under 18 to participate in that. We've waived the $25 fee for runners under 18. So we're encouraging cross-country teams and football teams and fall sports programs from high schools to come out there. Put your jerseys on. Hey, coaches, make it a team-building activity. We're looking forward to some exciting opportunities for you to showcase your school and have some school pride.
That all gets underway at the Focus Hope campus. That's at 1400 Oakman Boulevard in Detroit. How many people usually show up to this?
Well, we have over 1,000 pre-registered for the actual walk, and I'm looking at numbers growing daily for the actual 5K run. The walk itself will start at 1 o'clock, and we'll have activities starting as early as 11 o'clock for families and the community.
That is Jason Lee, the new executive director of Focus Hope in Detroit. Thanks for talking to us, and good luck.
I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan is being invaded, and you're being asked to report sightings of the invaders. More on that in a couple of minutes. First, let's meet Juliana Wilson. She's a tree-fruit integrated pest management outreach specialist at Michigan State University. So tell us about this invader, the brown marmorated stink bug.
Yes, it's a little shield-shaped brown insect that's about the size of a dime, and it has a habit of getting into people's houses at this time of year because it's looking for a place to hibernate. They come from Asia originally, and they are really good hitchhikers. We're not exactly sure how they ended up here in the first place, but we know the first reports of them came from Pennsylvania in about 1996. Within about 10 years, they became a serious agricultural pest for orchards, in particular apples and peaches. They love peaches.
Yeah, what do they do to them? They just eat them, or?
Yeah, they feed on them, and then the feeding damage will develop into, if it's on an early developing peach, it'll be severely deformed fruit. Later on, if it feeds on it, it'll cause depressions in the fruit, and just it makes it unsaleable. People don't like blemished fruit. And also, it doesn't store as well. So like in the case of apples, for instance, apples can go into storage if they've been fed upon by this insect, and we wouldn't even necessarily see the damage until a few weeks later. Or if they're pulled out of storage and they've been fed upon, then they'll have these depressions in the skin and sometimes a quirky texture underneath in the fruit. It can be really devastating when they're in high numbers.
Are there different kinds of stink bugs or just this one brown marmorated stink bug?
There are lots of different species of stink bugs, and we had a bunch of different species here in Michigan before this one arrived, but they're not usually considered to be any kind of a significant pest, at least in fruit production. They're more often a problem in field crops, but this particular one really loves fruit-bearing and pod-bearing plants. It's not just apples and peaches. So Tree of Heaven, which is present in a lot of urban areas, it's a weedy tree that just puts out millions of seeds every year. They love that plant, and they'll feed on it. English holly is another one that they go to that's like an ornamental plant. So it's different in that way to our native stink bugs. The other difference is that it doesn't have its natural enemies here yet. Our native stink bugs have evolved with all these other species that feed upon them, either laying eggs in them and, you know, just like the movie Alien, you know, they burst out of these insects and they basically suppress these populations of our native species. But we don't have natural enemies in high enough numbers at this point to suppress populations of this new invader.
For somebody who's not familiar with this, let's get down to why is it called a stink bug?
Okay, sure. Stink bugs, even our native stink bugs, when they're disturbed, they give off a chemical odor and, well, it stinks, I guess.
Right. I was going to say, one of the kids at the house stepped on one. It did stink. Now nobody will do anything with one of them crawling in the house. You have to shoo them out the door with a piece of paper or something.
Yeah.
So if I see one of these stink bugs crawling in my house, do I have to worry about anything? Do they bite? Do they spread disease? I mean, what's the big concern if they're in my house?
They're simply a nuisance in houses. They don't bite people or animals. They're plant feeders. Their mouth parts are like a straw. They don't bite. So the multicolored Asian lady beetle that was another home invader that comes and goes, those are just little ladybugs that they can actually bite because they have little pinching mouth parts, but these don't. They don't spread diseases. They are not nesting in a house. They're not laying eggs in there. They're not even eating during the winter. They're just looking for a place to hibernate. So if you shoo them out, they might be able to find their way back in because it's really impossible to close off all of the possible points of entry that this insect can find to get into houses.
Right. And don't step on one because it does stink. You're asking people to report where they're finding these stink bugs.
Right.
We'll have a link on our website. Tell us about the link and what you're asking people to do and how to do it.
I'm asking people to go to the Midwest Invasive Species Information Network. It's a place where you can report on any invasive species, but in particular, we were interested in having people report sightings of brown marmorated stink bugs so that we can keep track of the population as it grows in Michigan and where we're finding it. And it was really helpful a year ago when I first asked people to start doing this, because it told us that they're very well established in southern lower peninsula of Michigan.
We've been talking about the brown marmorated stink bug with Juliana Wilson. Juliana is a tree fruit IPM outreach specialist at Michigan State University. And again, we'll have that link on our website where you can report if you've sighted this pest. Juliana, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Ann Curzan is in the house. She is an English professor at University of Michigan and studies linguistics and the history of the English language and brings us That's What They Say here on Michigan, Michigan Radio. I was reading a Boston Globe piece by Mark Peters, and he brings up the term First Lady. Lady is not a term we hear much these days. How did we arrive at First Lady?
I think it's important to realize that First Lady doesn't go as far back as the first president, that I think it can be a term we take for granted and think, oh, it must always have been there for the wife of the president since we've always had men who are presidents.
Martha Washington wasn't the first lady.
She wasn't the first lady. From the evidence we have, the first use of it was for James Buchanan's niece. Mark Peters talks about this in the article. So it wasn't even used for a presidential wife because Buchanan was a bachelor. His niece was performing a lot of the duties of a president that a presidential wife would, and they couldn't call her Lady Buchanan. And so she was called the first lady in the land. And we know that Mary Todd Lincoln was sometimes referred to as the first lady. And it really seems to be sort of late 19th century that first lady takes hold.
And now we have FLOTUS, First Lady of the United States, rather than First Lady of the Land. POTUS and FLOTUS works really nice together,
it
I
does.
Think. So is that likely to change? Because we don't use the term lady that often.
I think it's a great question and one I've been thinking about. When you think about woman versus lady at this point has taken on some negative connotations. Woman might be seen as the more neutral term. Sometimes lady can feel like the polite term, but in the 1970s, the second wave feminism really argued for woman and said, when you make women ladies, you put them on a pedestal, and in that way, you restrict their movement, which I think is a great way to think about that. And so my question is, can First Lady survive when lady is not the preferred
term for women.
I saw that some of the other terms used in the past were Mrs. President or, this one's interesting, Lady Presidentress, which brings up that whole suffix tress as an actress. That's a whole other set of gender-related issues. So we've been losing that over the last couple of decades. Why has that changed and why did that matter?
Yeah, I think we've been moving away from marking women as the unusual group. If we think about something like author, do you need to mark that it's a woman author? Do you need to say authoress, or can everybody just be an author? And that seems to be where we're moving, is toward generic terms. We often now talk about the server in the restaurant as opposed to a waiter and a waitress.
Or firefighter or police officer or
flight
mail
attendant.
Carrier. Yes, right.
So those ESS terms, for the most part, are dropping out of the language. And I have to say, I don't really miss them.
When Jennifer Granholm was governor in Michigan, her husband was called the first gentleman. If Hillary Clinton becomes president, what do you think we'll end up calling Bill Clinton?
How about Bill Clinton?
That works.
I have to say, this question's floating around, and in some ways, first gentleman is the easy answer. But I think about the fact that we didn't always feel the need to refer to the wife of the president as the first lady, and maybe this would be a chance to say, we don't have to use first lady or first gentleman. We could call people by their names.
That works for me. I'm okay with that. That is Ann Curzon. She's a Michigan English professor. She also studies linguistics and the history of English language and brings us That's What They Say here on Michigan Radio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
As Michigan entrepreneurs diversify our state's economy, at our recent live show in Traverse City, stateside Cynthia Canty spoke with an enterprising couple whose business model banks on the inevitable.
The times are a-changing for the funeral industry, and a Traverse City company is right at the forefront of those changes. Listen to this. In 1960, about 3.5% of Americans were cremated. Last year, 2015, for the first time, more Americans were cremated than buried. And by 2030, that percentage is expected to hit 70%. That is a big, big shift. And Stardust Memorials is a company here in Traverse City that's built its entire business around selling cremation urns online. And business is booming. Stardust was ranked in Inc. Magazine's 500 list, making it among the nation's top fastest growing businesses. And it was ranked number 14 on the list of Michigan's fastest growing businesses. With us now, the husband and wife team who own Stardust Memorials, Marcy and Jordan Lindberg. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
So there is certainly no arguing that cremation is something that more Americans are choosing. I mean, when you stop and think, from 3.5% to more than 50%, and that's just a span of 51 years. Why do you think this is? Why are more Americans turning away from the traditional, you know, casket vault grave?
I think you have a couple different trends happening here. One is cost, and we've obviously been working through a recession over the last decade, and it was a much more affordable option to choose cremation. The other factor, I think, is families being spread all over our country. And so it used to be somebody passed away, the whole family would get together. Now it's like somebody's out in California, and who's going to handle this? And cremation makes it a lot easier. We have the person is ashes, and then we just figure out what to do with that at a time that's convenient for us. So those are two big ones, but a little bit too of changing attitudes about funerals and people wanting more of a celebration of life than perhaps the somber experience that was a traditional funeral in the past.
So they want to kind of start creating something for themselves, not do what has always been done.
Right.
I've got to ask you, it's an unusual business, Jordan. What brought the both of you to this business of selling cremation urns and scattering urns and cremation jewelry, and you're doing it online?
I started the company, and I really started the company because I had been involved in e-commerce for a long time prior to this, and I've been involved in consulting and working with companies that sell stuff online. And I wanted to get into that space myself, selling, because I had developed a skill set that made some sense. So what I was looking for was a project that fit. And I had made like a lot of people who are entrepreneurial, I sat home and I made a little economic model of what a good business would look like. And I went hunting, looking for something that fit. that had some logic to it that fit what I wanted it to be. There were a series of other things that intersected with this. My grandmother died, and I went through the process of helping to pick out a product for her, so I had that experience. I was on a board, a local board here in Traverse City, with a funeral director who was complaining about one of their suppliers. You have all these different sort of, this is a typical entrepreneurial story, but all these little parts kind of come together. So I made a little economic model. It seemed to make some kind of sense, and so I decided to give it a tumble. It was a cold start. I started the company the day after Thanksgiving 2010 and didn't sell anything until the following July. And then when I sold the first urn, I waited 4 days for the next one to sell. So fortunately, I had a job. You know, so it was okay. It was a slow start, but it gained momentum. It was a big investment as well. You know, we were buying and designing urns. We designed this one.
Well, I want to go to this because I went to your website, to the Stardust Memorial's website. I'm going to tell you guys, if you haven't, I was stunned at the kinds of choices you offer. It's not what I guess I thought I was going to see. I don't know what I thought I was going to see, but you've brought some samples. And I'm kind of curious, Marcy, what are some of the best sellers? What are people looking for?
Well, you have definitely the people who come to our site with an idea in mind, and it's probably what you had in mind, what you were just saying, what did I think?
Yeah.
Which is sort of a brass-type product, maybe with three bands around it, and it's pewter, and that's what you see in the movies a lot of times. So people will come, and then they'll see this array of choices. Or the person comes already frustrated that they've been to a funeral home and there's three choices and they
didn't like any of them.
It's America in the 21st century. We've got to have more out there. So we're the America in the 21st century with over 1,000 different urn and memorial products.
And you design
some of them.
Where do you source your materials from?
We have both a wonderful assortment of vendors in the United States. Mm-hmm. So we do have U.S.-made products, including this beautiful glass, hand-blown glass urn right in front of me. Almost all brass products are made in India. If people don't know that, your brass candlesticks at home are from India. Mm-hmm. So that very popular brass product, we import directly ourselves by container load from India.
And we were talking a little earlier saying people really do want to put their personal stamps. And what are some of the ways, what are some of the requests you get?
Well, we primarily offer engraving, and we've got a couple up here for engrave people's names. In fact, we just did recently a fun blog post on our website of the funniest things that people engrave on urns. We actually have a board in the office where we write, you know, it's just fun.
For instance?
The most famous is smoking hot, or smoking hot body now, things like that.
Yes, we did engrave that on an urn.
Yeah.
We did, and we sent it out.
Another favorite of our staff is, does this urn make my ash look big?
That is some, well, you know,
yep.
I also noticed you have dog and cat, and you have jewelry, and you brought us some sample. I was very stunned. You have Celtic jewelry, so somebody could wear that and keep someone close.
Right, yep. It takes about a little pinch of ashes, and it allows you to wear it. Some people wear them daily, but a lot of people wear it on that special occasion, an anniversary, mom's birthday, something like that.
Yeah, I know you talked about the cost, so some of this is economics, but is some of this interest in cremation urns and the cremation jewelry, is there some emotional shift in how we want to deal with dying and what we do when someone does that?
Again, kind of like I said at the beginning, I think there is the shift of the idea that this is a somber event. Not that people aren't taking it seriously, because they are, but they really want to express the personality of that person in a way that the traditional wood casket, it's the same wood casket, whatever funeral you went to. So you have something like this in front of us, you know, it's red, it has hearts on it, or it's elegant and black, and that, you know, my mom was so elegant and always dressed so nicely, that suits her. Or a camo urn, which is a very popular one we've got up here. The people of Northern Michigan know exactly a friend who would pick that one out. And that's more personal. So I think there's definitely that driving it, not just the engraving with a name, but does this somehow express their life or their personality?
Have you guys got yours picked out?
We have, tell the standing joke there.
Well, we have a thing we call the urn of the day. And so the staff go around and pick out their urn of the day. So if anything happens to any of us that day, we know what to do.
You know what to go. What's your urn of the day look like right now?
I really love the glass. I'd probably pick that.
The camel is in front of me, but I'm not this masculine. I don't think I can pull this off. So, we've got some really kind of cool brass ones that I really like. But it is funny. You'll walk in, you're having a bad day, and so you pick the somber color for that day. You know? And then the next day, you're feeling really good, so you get something gold. It's cool. So.
You know, and it is interesting. I just have to say, we're all kind of chuckling and doing that, and I guess that is really the healthy way to deal with that,
yeah.
Because we all know nobody's right. Getting out alive.
Nobody's getting out alive.
Go in the style we want to go in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Marcy and Jordan Lindbergh, Stardust Memorials, thank you so much for sharing your story and being with us today on Stateside.
Last month, September 10th, there was an incident at the Kinross Correctional Facility in the UP. It started with a peaceful demonstration by prisoners and ended with a fire, smashed windows, and other vandalism. 250 inmates were moved to higher security prisons. The spokesman for the Michigan Department of Corrections, Chris Gouts, calls it, and it says, you can call it an incident, you can call it vandalism, don't call it a riot.
This is not, by any stretch of the imagination, would be considered a riot. I mean, all the dictionaries on my shelf and the dictionaries on your shelf would draw the same conclusion. Mr. Webster is on my side on this case. It wasn't a riot. It was, though, a very serious situation.
The Union for Corrections Officers sees it differently. Tom Tlutke is with Michigan Corrections Organizations, the MCO.
It was a riot. To call it anything else is amazing. I hear terms being thrown out about the Webster's Dictionary, but MCO was at the prison. We saw tapes, live footage of what were several hundred inmates out of control, doing damage to the physical plant, not obeying the rules.
So we've heard from the department. We've heard from the guards. Today, Detroit Free Press published a piece that allows us to hear from the prisoners. Paul Egan wrote that story, and he joins us now. So the Department of Corrections agrees the prisoners were headed back to their housing units. Then something changed. Can you pick up the story from there?
Sure. They actually were in their housing units. They returned to their housing units. And the department had a plan, basically. They wanted to round up the instigators, about 50 people that they believed had organized this demonstration in the yard, which was a peaceful demonstration, but, you know, involved inmates refusing to go back to their units when told to. So the department was very concerned about it. And the plan that they came up with, because they felt that this was going to lead to some resistance, they evacuated all the non-custodial personnel. They brought in emergency response teams armed with shotguns and pepper guns from a number of nearby prisoners and even from the Lower Peninsula, over 100 of these armed people. And it was when they sent those emergency response teams into the housing units that some of the inmates began breaking sinks, smashing windows. There was actually a dryer thrown through a window, went into an office where they ransacked files, set some of those on fire. Significant amount of damage. We still haven't had a total damage estimate from the department.
So you were in contact with some prisoners. You talked to one. You had some letters from a couple. What are they saying sparked that outburst?
Well, the department says, and it's hard to really argue with this, that it's really hard to make the case that the inmates, some of the inmates might be making, that you know, that in any way this damage could be justified by what the department did. And I think what we can get from what some of the inmates are saying is more of a question about tactics. The department wanted to round up these ringleaders. Was there a way they could have done it that was less confrontational, that perhaps would have resulted in less damage? And, you know, the department says nobody was injured, and that in itself shows that the operation was a success. But, you know, what I'm hearing from some of the inmates is kind of interesting, is that the inmates who had not participated in any of the demonstrations, and in some cases had to stand up to threats from other inmates who had been encouraging anyone who didn't want to get involved that they better get out in the yard. So those inmates that hadn't really done anything were basically treated the same as everybody else, or in some cases worse, because what you had was they moved into the prison unit by unit, zip-cuffed everybody's wrists behind their hands, put them out in the yard, found the ones they wanted to take out, and those inmates that were being moved to other prisons were actually put into buses where they were, you know, they at least had a roof over their head. A number of inmates have said that they were left you know, for several hours, raining off and on, cool temperatures, couldn't go to the bathroom. What I'm hearing from some of the inmates is that they felt that some of the people that weren't involved in the demonstration were treated in some ways worse than those that were.
So it sounds like nobody's happy in this thing. The prisoners who had the peaceful demonstration ended up vandalizing the place because these other types of guards came in. The Department of Corrections is not happy with the inmates because they destroyed things. The union's not happy with the Department of Corrections because of what they're calling it. And, of course, the inmates are not happy with the guards in the department because of the way they handle it toward the end. This is just pretty chaotic. Do we have any idea what led to what these grievances were? We know one of them was complaints about food. Is there anything else that's going on that we know of about the grievances?
The one at the top of the list this time was actually prison wages. And, I mean, some people might even be surprised to know that prisoners get paid for prison work, but they do get paid, but it's a very small amount of money, and there's a bit of a range, but you know, you can be talking less than a dollar a day to, you know, to $2 or $3 a day. And what some of the inmates are saying, and I haven't gone into depth on this issue of what they have to buy, but they say, you know, for example, the toothbrush that they get, they claim some that, you know, that they're not good enough, you can't get your teeth clean with it, so they have to buy a toothbrush, they have to buy deodorant, they have to buy other items through this kind of prison canteen service, which, you know, is going to be more costly than shopping at your local dollar store. So, you know, that they can never get enough money in to buy the stuff they need into their bank at the prison, and that they have to rely on family members. You know, also they don't like the food. They're trying to buy food to supplement their diets. They say that the quantity and quality is not enough to live on. So that was a big issue, apparently, wages for prison work. And also there's a lot of lifers at this prison, even though they're considered low security. You have a lot of people serving life sentences for murder, and they had concerns about how they get access to a possible commutation of their sentences from the governor, which the department actually says is something that, you know, that already everyone has equal access to. There's no special waiting line or anything that's something really beyond their control. It's between the inmates and the governor.
I understand this is also part of a nationwide demonstration at all prisons, and this is the only one that had a problem.
Right. The day before, actually, was a nationwide protest was planned, and this related, a large part of that related to the wage issue. It was the anniversary of the Attica prison riots, and the idea was that prisoners were not going to show up for their prison jobs, and at least from what we're told by the department and to a certain extent from inmates and others, is that Kinross was the only prison in Michigan where the workers didn't show up for their jobs. And that in some ways, you know, ended up contributing to this whole disturbance because they didn't show up for their kitchen jobs. There were bag lunches made, you know, you don't get a hot meal then. And that carried over into breakfast on Saturday. There was another bag meal given rather than anything hot. And that, you know, there's been some suggestions that contributed to the demonstration Saturday morning, where you had hundreds of inmates gathered in the yard at Kinross.
Paul, thanks very much for adding a few more facts to this story. Appreciate it. That's Paul Egan with the Detroit Free Press. We've been talking about the Kinross Correctional Facility and the incident that happened there last month. Thanks much.
Thanks, Lester.
We always want to hear from you. Yep, you sitting there listening right now. What stories are you focused on? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. And, of course, at michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. 50 years ago tomorrow, there was an event that not a lot of people are talking about these days, but it was documented in a 1975 book called We Almost Lost Detroit, by Detroit reporter John Grant Fuller. The Fermi 1 nuclear power plant next to Lake Erie, just a few miles northeast of Monroe, Michigan, had a partial fuel meltdown. We should note the owners of Fermi 1, DTE, published its own account of the Fermi 1 meltdown called We Did Not Almost Lose Detroit. DTE says what happened at Fermi 1 has been exaggerated. Michael Keegan is a member of the Coalition for a Nuclear-Free Great Lakes, and he joins us now. I understand you're going to be holding an event to mark the anniversary. What are you doing?
Albert Einstein tells us, to the village square, we must carry the facts of atomic energy. From there must come America's voice. So tomorrow at 3:09 at LaRonger Square in Monroe, Michigan, downtown Village Square, we will be holding a press conference to review the 50 years to the day, to the minute, since the core melt accident at the Fermi 1. And we've got Union of Concerned Scientists David Lockbaum, a nuclear engineer, will be giving us the official edition of what occurred at the plant.
I've interviewed him many times, yes.
Yes.
Is this just raising awareness of the near miss that was Fermi 1 50 years ago?
Well, the Fermi 1 was 50 years ago, but it still continues to this day, the legacy. The plant was rapidly disassembled in 1972 through 75, but the carcass is still there.
Right.
And actually, they want to build a Fermi 3 right on top of the Fermi 1. And in doing so, they have to, because it is a historical site, they have to establish a official recordation. And we tried to intervene to actually have some input into that official recordation, and we were denied. But the accident occurred October 5th, 1966. But there were run-ups to the accident. This reactor was problematic from its onset in testing. In January, they were having problems. And earlier that month of October, they were having problems. They were having problems the day before and the day of. And these were problems that they ignored, overheating issues. They ignored it until radiation alarms sounded and they realized that they had fuel melting going on.
Right, because the coolant was not getting through like it should. Some kind of plugged problem there. I want to look at the big picture, if I might, just for a second. You mentioned Fermi 3. DTE has gotten an application for that. Fermi 2 is just about to get final approval for a renewal of its license. Because of concerns about climate change and stricter emission standards, nuclear is seeing something of a resurgence, not just here but around the world. What do you think can be done to make nuclear more safe in the Great Lakes region?
Well, I don't agree with there's a resurgence. They talk about a renaissance, but it's largely been a relapse and it's a fizzle. And nuclear power is not the salvation to climate change. You get very little benefit from nuclear power. If you'd spent your money, for instance, the price tag on the Fermi 3 proposed price tag is now approaching $20 billion. And it would be a decade before a plant would be built to get any relief on greenhouse gases. If you spent that $20 billion in renewables, alternative energies, wind, solar, geothermal, conservation, you would get much more bang for the buck. So the economics are just stupid. But it is a lucrative cash cow that the industry and the utilities want to pursue, because if they could put us on the hook for $20 billion, they're going to make a lot of money.
I want to talk about another problem with the nuclear industry. One of the major concerns is the fact that the U.S. has no plan to deal with spent nuclear fuel. The Obama administration killed the Yucca Mountain disposal plan. That means the default plan is storing the spent nuclear fuel in casks at nuclear power plants. And for the Great Lakes region, that means spent nuclear fuel is stored right next to a Great Lake. How much of a concern is that?
So it's a tremendous concern. Over at Palisades on the western part of the state on Lake Michigan, there are canisters loaded. They were loaded in 1994, and one of them was known to be faulty, and it's still faulty. It's a tremendous concern. The product is poison. The electricity is fleeting. You have it for a few decades. It's gone. What you're left with is a toxic waste, highly radioactive nuclear waste, that's toxic for tens of thousands of years and has to be isolated from the biosphere. So it's morally irrehensible that they're producing this poison with no place to take it, no known solution. No country in the world has resolved this. So it's a major problem. And here in Monroe, at the Fermi plant, they are now storing high-level nuclear waste on the shore. They consider these casks good for their initially licensed for 20 years. They can be relicensed for 5 times, and then they allow a 20-year cooling-off period. So what they consider temporary is 140 years. That's 2 biblical lifetimes. That's not a temporary situation. And yet there's been no environmental impact statement on what is the risk involved storing this waste on the shores of Lake Erie, the Great Lakes, at every single nuclear reactor. No environmental impact statement has been done.
So how do you think your event tomorrow will go over and be seen by folks when you've got these concerns, these larger concerns, as well as the historic ones?
We're trying to put forth a cautionary tale here. The Fermi 1 had a core melt. It was an experimental reactor. The Fermi 3, the proposed Fermi 3, this design has never been built before. This is an experimental design. Here we go all over again. And it's about the pursuit. With the Fermi 1, it was about the pursuit of plutonium, weapons-grade plutonium. Fermi 3, it's about the pursuit of capital. And the whole, this nuclear renaissance, the entire thing is predicated on somebody else is going to pay the tab. Detroit Edison's not putting their money in it. They're looking to get construction work under progress from ratepayers as they're building it to get it into the rate base. And they're looking to get federal loan guarantees, which is taxpayer money. Detroit Edison will not put their skin in the game. Venture capitalists will not put the skin in the game. Stockholders don't want it. But it's a big cash cow. And if they could spend our money doing it, building it, they'd be happy to dig a hole in the ground, making money hand over fist in the process.
Michael Keegan is with the Coalition for a Nuclear-Free Great Lakes. Thanks very much for talking with us about the event tomorrow.
Thank you, Lester. Take care.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ali Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Liz Dickey. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.